Welcome to BIT, the Brilliant Investment Thinkers podcast. Where the Inside Network, a community of financial professionals, come together to discuss the things that matter in advice, investing, and life. Covering everything from growing businesses to regulation and investing. Our guests will reflect on a lifetime in financial services, sharing their stories, knowledge, and experience. And now, here's your podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Brilliant Investment Thinking Shared podcast. I'm Tan Sharp, Managing Editor at the Inside Network and your host for today's pod. Well, some might say it's never been more difficult to provide compliant financial advice, and that may be true. Indeed, it's a refrain we hear repeatedly when interviewing advisors, which probably suggests that over the last decade or so, the regulatory noose has just been getting tighter and tighter. That 10-year period was kicked off by FOFA, of course, which you'd all know, banned conflicted remuneration and introduced best interest duty. After a few years of bedding that down, the regulatory machine kicked back into gear with the financial advisor education and ethics standards, and then the LIF reforms, which limited insurance commissions. Soon after, of course, the Haim Royal Commission occurred, which predicated another swathe of changes, all at a time when ASIC was in the middle of an aggressive look-back campaign, which they never really officially acknowledged, but I think every licensee and advisor would be familiar with and probably felt the brunt of at some stage. So that tone kind of changed when the pandemic hit and the nation remembered how important the availability of financial advice really was. But the regulatory settings weren't finished tightening, with advice fee consent rules coming in mid-2021. And then you had what became known as the Red October suite of reforms later that year, which effectively wrapped up the Royal Commission mandate. There were six more changes there, including design and distribution obligations, extended breach reporting rules, and reference checking obligations for licensees. Of course, amongst all that, you had a host of changes to contribution limits, pension arraignments, SFSF trusteeship. They were all introduced, so it really kept advisors on their toes. Now, that regulatory recap I've just gone through is just to set the scene. But on today's pod, I don't so much want to focus on the merits of those regulatory changes, whether they were good or bad, but rather on how advisors have been coping with the job of providing compliant advice through all that. For this discussion, we've brought in Sean Graham from Assured Support, who I think is not only infinitely smarter than I am, but someone who has a clear view of the compliance burden, given that's the area he helps advisors with day in, day out. Now, Sean, before I start, good morning. How are you today?
I'm fantastically well, and thanks for the invitation.
That's all right. When I was preparing this podcast, I remembered an interesting quirk. The term Red October, in reference to those reforms introduced in 2021, actually came from you. I recall hearing it from you in a conversation, I think, over lunch, including it in a story, and then it's spreading across trade press and the industry at large. So congratulations on your contribution to the lexicon.
Yeah, thank you very much. It was very surprising when it was repeated back to me and attributed to ASIC or something else. It just shows how our industry works and how sort of insular it is as well.
It was also very appropriate,
yeah,
I think,
yeah,
at that time, yeah, and had a nice kick to it. So, Sean, maybe we could set the table a little bit here and you can tell me what advisors are doing really well at the moment.
Can I just address you had a very evocative opening about the noose tightening and whatever else. I actually think that hasn't been a better time to be an advisor. Like, the opportunities around now are incredible. Practices are actually thriving in the current environment, and certainly the ones that we're dealing with. Where the uncertainty comes down to is in a couple of areas. One is about uncertainty about the future. Like, we've got a financial planning and a financial advice industry that's operationalized the FSCA code, that's operationalized best interest and client priority, and wrapped their heads around it, figured out ways to actually address it in a quite effective manner. And now they're worried about, well, in a year that might go. And if it goes in a year, what do I do now? How do I prepare for that? So that's the biggest challenge for a lot of practices at the moment, and then recruiting new advisors. So where do the new advisors come from, given that everybody's gone out there? So it's a very positive time, not just for compliance people, but for advisors as well. So from that perspective, I think it's looking good. When we look at what's happening with advisors, what we're seeing year on year, and we're really data-driven business, what we've seen is every year since 2020, the quality of advice has improved. So even as the regulators and licensees tighten their settings, advisors have been very, very good at adapting it. So if you look back at the data in 2020 and you just look at the code, for example, so how were advisors and licensees preparing for the implementation of the code of ethics and the standards? Well, they were doing it very badly, right? So this was a year where a lot of advisors were exiting the big institutional licensees, setting up their own practices and their own licenses. And what we found in that first year is a lot of them didn't know anything about the code or standards. They weren't. And so there was a bit of a regulatory shock for a lot of those guys initially. So they came out and suddenly, what do you mean in standard 3? What does I didn't vote for that. You know, why do I have to do something here? And so there were businesses that had to spend that first year rethinking their business model. A lot of them in the old days, the practice would decide to adopt MDAs, for example, managed accounts. And so they'd implement that in their advice business. And then some of them would go, well, we can get another clip of the ticket if we set ourselves up as the investment consultant as well. So they'd set up a separate company and charge for that advice and effectively get two fees from that one transaction. And when you talk about standard 3, it really got them to take a step back and think about their business and what they're actually providing. And so that first year was about businesses and advisors grappling with the code. But then you got into, you know, 2022 and they're all over it. A lot of the issues that we've seen in 2021 just weren't there. Like, they really dealt with them. And that's why I'm optimistic about the way advisors deal with it. There's not to say there's not a lot of complaints, and I'm sure there are a lot of advisors and practices which do struggle.
Sure.
Because they either get the wrong advice or take the wrong approach. But as a general rule, I think it's a really good story for an industry that's been buffeted by frequent regulatory changes, and some of them are uncertain and unclear. There's a lot of ambiguity in the law. They've done exceptionally well.
Do you think some of that could be attributed to the advisors who aren't in the industry anymore? Do you think some of that could also be put down to the regulatory changes being good and effective? Or is it more so just a case of people getting used to them and better at them?
Yeah, I think there's a combination of both things. A lot of the, if we go back a long, long time, back in the Wayback Machine, I remember back when IPS 146 was introduced. So IPS 146 became, PS 146 became RG 146, right? Minimum competencies for advisors. And when that was first introduced, there were a lot of advisors who said, this is the end. I'm getting out of the industry. And then when you looked at how it was implemented, if you're basically competent, it was a very low standard for most advisors.
Yes.
A lot of the people who left didn't have to leave. They could have stayed, but there was that apprehension of the future and the fear and the uncertainty that caused them to leave, and they became quite bitter about the industry's gone to the dogs, it's whatever else. And so we get that all the time, because one of the realities of dealing in financial services is you can never get bored, because it changes all the time. The moment you get used to something, there'll be a class action or a case that hits the courts, or ASIC will come out with a media release, and you have to change things up.
Yes.
And regulatory expectations change, stakeholder expectations change. The whole idea about social licensing, when that came in a couple of years ago, then larger licensees had to start to think about, well, do we have obligations beyond just making money and giving returns to shareholders? So it's a great industry to be in from that perspective, but it does take a certain level of energy and enthusiasm.
And agility, I would say.
Agility and madness to stay in that industry, right? When you could go and get a 7-Eleven franchise and it'd be a much simpler proposition from that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a massive exercise in looking for a silver lining there, saying that there's shifting goalposts have really kept everyone fresh and energized. But there is a modicum of truth to that. So I take your point.
Well, I mean, most of the data suggests that in most careers, you've got to reinvent your career every 7 years, right? Because your education and your experience become stale as the market changes. In financial services, it's changing every year. So even if you didn't want to, you're forced to change. So your skills are always being updated and changed in a way that a lot of other professions don't do as well.
Yeah, I think a lot of advisors do actually appreciate that, to be honest. But it's more so the ones that don't, the ones that moan about the changes that you hear from, which is fair enough. That's always been the case, I think, from our perspective. And we have a pretty good view on who's got things to say about where we're sitting in the regulatory landscape. And we hear most from the people that speak the loudest, which are the people that are unhappy. That's just the way of things. Yep. I get that. But you mentioned things getting better, and I love this positive outlook, but what is getting better? Is it the record keeping? Is that getting more consistent and clearer?
Yeah, I'd like to say yes. It's really sporadic in that perspective. Because some advisors and some licensees that are all over the record keeping, they've digitised their records, they're doing it effectively, or they're using Xplan or the CRMs more effectively. But I've got to balance that with the quality of the record keeping. So some of those groups that are keeping records, their records are still appalling, right, because the discovery process is bad. The fundamental underpinning of good advice is a really effective discovery process, right? Your ability to sit down with a client and understand what they're looking for, understand their circumstances, consider the strategies that are going to achieve those goals and plot out that process. That requires a lot of work and analysis, right? So good record keeping and good advisors spend a lot of time on that, far less time on product selection
right. And
the disclosure stuff, because that's the heart of the best interest duty.
The discovery process.
Understanding what your client's about, what they need, and how you're going to get them to that point, right? And if you can get that done. So in terms of record keeping is improving, right? We are seeing advisors spending time recording stuff and, interestingly, using technology better. So you mentioned COVID in the introduction. One of the great things that did is it caused advisors to think about technology and the way in which they can engage with the clients, because clients didn't want to come in and they couldn't see them. So what do they use? Well, they start to use Zoom and alternatives. That gives them a great way to actually document the meetings they're having with their clients. So suddenly they're a bit more advanced because they've got a record that they can refer back to, right? So you can see when you're recording those meetings, you can see how clients are reacting when you're raising concerns. Because, you know, one of the issues is that you often, did the client understand? You know, so the first set of standards, for example, require the advisor to have a reasonable belief that the client reasonably understood the strategy and gave free, informed and prior consent. Now, when you've got a video, you can actually see that, because you can see when the lights go on or off in the client's faces. Like we saw one recently last year where the advisor's finance said, explained the strategy, a client got it, really keen to proceed. Then you watch the video and you could see the life had gone out of the client's face. They switched off completely. And sure, they were saying yes, because they just were trying to get through the meeting. And it was quite obvious when you saw the video. But if you just read the file notes, you'd think, oh, everything's great. The client was really engaged. They said yes, yes, yes all the time. But there was a disconnect.
Are more advisors using videos now?
Some of them are. Some of them are figuring out, but it hasn't become a standardised thing. There's a lot of energy and enthusiasm about the video SOA at the moment. And, you know, good luck to them. I think the video SOA will be the equivalent of the wedding video. I reckon that it'll be produced, you'll watch it once, and then occasionally drag it out to torture yourself in the future.
And then eventually tape over it for the football game or something like that.
I don't think that's really solving the problem. So the problem we've got with advice generally is that the advice we're producing is boilerplate and dense and inaccessible, because we've got to this view that we've got to do things in a certain way, and it suits some of the technology companies that here is a template, you fill out these sections and whatever else. And in a way, even though that's industrialised the process and made it easier for people to produce SOAs, it's really retarded the development of the profession, because instead of composing like a short four-page document explaining what I'm thinking and why I'm thinking it and why it's good for you, we've tried to make ourselves think in a particular fashion. So like we look at thousands of SOAs, right? So you look at them and you could pick an SOA from an institutional licensee in Queensland and one from a boutique financial planner in Perth, and they're largely identical, right?
Yes.
There's the advisor's voice doesn't come through. There's no distinctiveness to the advice they're providing. They're not explaining things in a way that they explained it to the client,
right, or
in a way that the client understands it, because they've been conditioned to think, I've got to do it in this templated fashion.
They're longer and templated. I know a lot of people talking about the 100-page SOA and the need to get rid of that, and I'd come to the conclusion that it was slightly hyperbolic, that people don't actually give 100-page SOAs. But I saw one recently that was over 120 pages, and I realised that that's still a big issue. There's longer templated SOAs instead of those shorter, you know, four-page ones with the things that matter. And you know, if you speak to a compliance expert or a legal expert, a lot of the times they'll tell you that it needs to be that way to keep people safe. But here we have a compliance expert saying, no, that's not required.
No, you can certainly get to a much shorter SOA. There are a couple of things that work against that ambition. One is the technology we use. So a lot of the providers of the planning software have models that they roll out. Right? Here is our template and whatever else. And there's not a lot of interest in customizing that, because then they've got to do it across the board. So then you live with, well, do I use a third-party provider to customize it and change it? And there's cost and inconvenience. But the biggest one is fear. Advisors and licensees are terrified about innovating in financial services because the upside is far less than the downside. They live in constant fear, and whether or not it's reasonable or not, they live in constant fear that ASIC are going to ping them, right?
And shut their business down. There's no real function to vet something with ASIC,
no,
is there?
No. It's like the ATO, you can get private determinations, and we can argue about how useful and effective those are. ASIC won't give views on things, because you can understand they're the referee, right? It's like playing football and going out, okay, you know, what should we do today, ref? You know, what strategy should we use to maximize the points we're going to put on the opposition? That's not their job. Their job is to make sure that the markets are operating efficiently, that consumers are protected, and that participants comply with the law. Yes, they shouldn't give
that
direction.
They limit themselves to guidance.
That's what they have to. I mean, I think they do that quite effectively. That it's in the interest of everyone in the financial services industry that we're a consistent and predictable and effective regulator, right? So that the people who aren't doing the right thing are out, and are out quickly, so that they don't tarnish the reputation of the industry. But the issue is, if there are so many penalties associated with these things, even if ASIC aren't going to effectively use them, or they aren't going to do them, people are disinclined to take a risk.
Sure.
Right? I don't want to be banned from the industry for 3 years because I decided to reduce my SOA by a page.
Mm. Okay, so longer, still templated SOA is currently still an issue in advice, and not being able to or willing to take a risk, and I think we can understand the drivers behind that. So they're issues, but what are advisors actually breaching on? So what are the sort of the legal mistakes that are being made? What do you actually pull people up about?
Okay, so there are a couple of issues there. And I don't want to create the impression that people aren't innovating, right? There are practices and advisors who are doing things, but there's a degree of conservatism. And
sure,
this is one of the issues with the quality of advice review, is that it doesn't address the real issue in financial services, which is the fear of penalties. If they had, for example, created a legitimate safe harbour for an advisor to say, I've acted reasonably, I acted with due diligence and with care and in line with my professional obligations, something went wrong, I shouldn't be liable for that. I've done everything that a prudent professional would have done, in the way that most professionals have some type of protection. Directors have safe harbours, well, in a similar way. Financial advisors don't have that, and they've got penalties from everything, from handing out disclosure documents to the nature of the disclosure. So it's very difficult. Where they're actually going wrong at the moment, and it's generally about the more fundamental issues, right? So forget about the documents. Documents should be, even those 120-page templates, they meet the legal requirements. Remember, the law is just about minimum legal requirements.
Yes.
So here's the bottom line. If you want to just get over the line, you've just got to do this. So they should be able to do that type of stuff. Where advisors get themselves into trouble is they rely too much on that and less about exercising their professional judgment. Their job is to apply their education, their expertise and their experience to the client's circumstance and come up with a solution to whatever the problem. Where they fail is they don't ask what the problem is, right? Advisors come in, and you can see this in a number of cases where it's absolutely clear what the advisor was going to do before the client came in. And irrespective of what the clients told them,
sure,
they've gone, no, I've got an MDA, so what you need is an MDA, even if that's not what your issue is. I've got relatively simple investment circumstances. I've got like 10 investments. I just want to keep those types of things. I don't need an MDA. But they push it along. So it's that consideration. And it's the application of a real intent to act in the client's best interest. So in some cases, it's more about, you know, volume, get the clients through, get it done from that perspective, and whether it's record keeping or that analysis. So there's a real dearth in some cases of thinking about what the options are. Mm. So often you get into conversations with advisor and you go, well, what alternatives did you consider before you recommended your MDA? Oh, there were no alternatives. Well, hang on. There's generally alternative to everything. What did you think about? And most advisors, to their credit, think about alternatives. They're just really bad about documenting it because they go, it's obvious.
Sure. Is it the documentation or is it the process?
It's a combination of both. Yep. You know, there are some good advisors who let themselves down through their documentation or their process, but it's generally a combination of the two. Good advisors can generally comply with their law without too many dramas. And I think one of the reasons, paradoxically, why the SOA was 100 and 120 pages is because it gave a lot of places to hide. Like if you weren't a really good advisor, 120 pages, a lot of places you can distract attention and
a lot of whatever charts. Else.
If you've got to reduce your advice down to 2 pages, right, and you've got to encapsulate everything into that 2 pages, you've got to know your stuff.
Yeah.
And so that's the real challenge. And I understand that from an advisor's perspective is that, sure, I could write this down as a letter over 3 pages or whatever else, but I'm taking a lot of risk. It's going to take a lot more time. And then you get to the issue about, well, then maybe it's a pricing issue. It's not about a compliance issue. It's about a pricing issue, is that you haven't valued your advice enough to do the work that you want to do and that your clients will really appreciate.
So you think sometimes it's a matter of overcompensating for what you might perceive as being not enough value showed to a client?
Yeah, I remember dealing with an advisor a couple of years ago and I'd reduced the SOA down to 10 pages and he said, I can't use that. I said, why not? And he goes, because I charge my clients X dollars. Then I'm going to want to pay that amount for 10 pages. And I said, but it's not the 10 pages. It's all the wisdom and insight that you've squeezed into those 10 pages. It's your IP. That's what's valuable. It's not the document itself. But he couldn't get over that.
Yes.
That bar. And that's the challenge for advisors, is appreciating the level of expertise they're bringing to a complex situation. And their expertise should be about taking that complexity and making it simple and accessible to their client, because the client wants a solution and they want to be reassured.
Does the client bear any responsibility there? Do you think clients are almost demanding?
I think we've created a situation where clients don't have to accept responsibility and they're not expected to, because did you read the 120 pages? No. Well, it's not reasonable for someone to read 120 pages. You remember the report that ASIC put out about the limitations of disclosure?
Yes.
594, I think it was. I'll have to check that one. But well, they make the point there. People aren't stupid. Life's hard, right? It's really complex to try to reduce complex things, even a simple decision about a credit card. You know, well, do you want to look at fees? Do you want to look at interest rate? Or do you want to look at... There are so many things that you need to consider. Now, advisors do that routinely, like, because they're every day they're thinking about products and strategies and how it will all fit together. If we can communicate that information simpler, then we can put more of the responsibility on a client to say, I understood that.
Sure.
And that's what the code's really driving at.
Now, we've obviously got a quality of advice review coming, and a lot of the changes that are proposed by Michelle Levy involve or are aimed at fixing things so that SOAs can be shorter and less complicated, and that takes care of the access part, because yeah, it then becomes cheaper. But is there anything in there that you see that'll actually work? You know, whether it's looking at advice fee consent reforms and sort of condensing that into one, or is there anything that will actually reduce the size of SOAs or what advisors feel compelled to turn them into?
I think the idea about reducing the size of the SOA is, you know, everyone wants that. We all want that. But not only too critical of Michelle Levy's report, I think some of her recommendations are really good. It's just that based on our data and our involvement in advice on a really granular level, we have a different view of what the problems are. So we don't see the problem is the SOA or the requirements of the SOA. It's that penalty, all those penalties that are associated with contraventions of that.
Right.
And that means that people won't take a chance and simplify advice because they're terrified of civil penalty provisions or administrative sanctions. So our view is, if you address that, if you can give a reassurance to the industry that, you know, you act professionally, you comply with these principles, whether it's a standard or the code, you act in this manner and you act in a manner that exercises or demonstrates due care and diligence and a focus on your client, then you don't have to worry that ASIC are going to take your business away or come in or shut you down. So telling people, I will remove the mandatory requirements, well, that doesn't solve the problem, because they're still worried about, but what does that mean for me as an advisor? What do I do and how do I avoid the threat of the regulator? And
sure,
that's what they're worried about. So I think I would have preferred Michelle Levy to focus on, let's, even before we do that, let's look at the penalty provisions. And it might be that the Australian Law Reform Commission, who are looking at Chapter 7, will address that. And that's where I suspect why the government's dragging their feet on the QAR, because they know the Australian Law Reform Commission is looking at Chapter 7, is going to come back with a series of recommendations. Why not wait? Why not wait to see what the law, what the broader community of lawyers and regulators are thinking, and then reconcile the two?
Yes, it's a good question. And I hosted a panel with the President of the Law Reform Commission not too long ago and broached that with her. And my sense is that we won't get anything from that review for another 7 or 8 years.
Yes.
So waiting could be a long wait, that's for sure.
Well, I thought 2 to 3 years, but no. 7 or 8.
So I think by the time it gets implemented and goes through assent processes.
Okay.
I also suspect that they're really just looking at the architecture of the Corporations Act, and they may still split it, you're right, and take out Chapter 7, which could have some far-reaching benefits. But I've learned not to place too much short-term stock or too much hope in the law reform.
Oh, so I'm an optimist. As a compliance person, I'm naturally optimistic, so.
Yes, you are very optimistic today. It's a wonderful change, Sean. Okay, well, let's change tax for a second. But before I do that, I just want to ask, you would see enough SOAs to have a good view on this. What's the average length of an SOA today?
Well, it's probably about 40 pages.
Is that right?
Yeah. We're working with a number of groups at the moment to take stuff out, and they're really reluctant because they'll put in, you know, here are all these models and all this stuff, and you go, but does the client value that? Is it helping the client understand what your recommendation's about? Because, like with your analysis, so what you say, put that in your working papers. It'll be in your client file. If the client wants to see it, you can produce it. But you should be able to explain in your SOA why you're doing it and what the benefits are.
Mm.
You can say, I've modelled it over 20 years and here's going to be the outcome based on these circumstances. I should be able to explain that. I shouldn't have to put in, you know, a two-page modelling exercise. Likewise, if I'm replacing products, the obligation is on me as an advisor to say, well, here's why I'm doing it. I'm replacing product A with product B for these reasons. You're going to lose these things. You're going to lose other issues as well, but they're not relevant to what you want.
Sure.
But you're going to lose access to, you know, reduce mortgage rates through the Associated Bank. You don't have a mortgage with them at the moment, so it doesn't really matter. And even though the product might be more expensive, I think you're going to be better off for these reasons, and that's why I've done it. Instead of these, you know, 4 or 5 pages of ticks and crosses that come out of the system that are, you know, indecipherable and pointless. Clients don't care. They're paying you for your advice, right? They don't want to get 10 pages of product comparisons. If they were going to do that, why wouldn't they do that themselves? We're going to move away from this idea that a financial advisor is a product salesperson or an executor, right? So ASIC addressed this point in a number of recent actions is that, you know, an advisor is not an order taker. Your obligation to act in your client's best interest means that sometimes you've got to say, Tarn, that's a really stupid thing to do. We're not going to do it. It's not in your interest. If you want to do it, go and see the account down the road, or I'm not participating. And that's what too many advisors don't do. And we see that a lot with self-managed super, where they'll come in and they'll say, I've spoken to my accountant. He said I should set up a self-managed super fund. Sure, let's do it. And the advisor will help them out without ever thinking about, well, hang on, is this appropriate for you? Do you have the capacity to actually, do you have the time? Yeah. And we see this a lot. One of the things we're seeing with self-managed super at the moment in particular is that more advisors are recommending clients unwind self-managed super funds than they are recommending them. And that could be as a consequence of clients aging. But I'll talk about one we dealt with recently where when you looked at the year-on-year engagement between the clients and the advisor. In 1 year, the advisor had noted that the clients were elderly, trustees were elderly, and they were looking like the husband was losing his capacity.
Capacity, yep.
Right? And then next year, they meet with them again, and everything continues. And the advisor notes, oh, at some point, I might have to talk to them about unwinding it. Because it was clear from the notes that the wife had no real participation in it, didn't understand it, was grappling with the complexity. And the husband who was driving it was losing his capacity. But the advisor never saw it as their duty to say, maybe now's the time to actually start to unwind it or think about this, because we've got to prepare for the future. We can't leave your wife in a situation where she can't handle or manage what's in place.
But as you said, things do seem to be getting better on the compliance side. So I think that, and to be fair, I think it's a lot of the honing of the advice cohort as well. There's, I think that the standard of advice is so much better. The standard of advisor left in the industry is so much better. That just makes sense with the industry trends over the last few years. So I think advisors are getting much better at being proactive and not being facilitators, because that's where the value is in actually challenging clients. And that notion where you just want to keep the clients happy and be a facilitator and give them everything that they state they want without challenging them, I think it is becoming less. Is that
it is becoming less. It's still
prevalent.
What's that, 10-15% of issues where they won't challenge it. Or, for example, I'll give you a recommendation about your investments within your self-managed super, and you say, have you looked at the trust deed? I know the accountant's got that. Well, have you looked at it? No, but the accountant's got it. You know, it's about figuring out what your role is and being able to manage those obligations. The conflicts are also being dragged out as well. One of the great things about the industry over the past couple of years is it's had a good hard look at itself through the lens of the Royal Commission and thought about, what do we actually do? Are we an advice business, or are we an advice business and a self-managed super business and an administrator and a self-managed super, and are we also an MDA operator, and trying to figure out what they focus on. And that's driven a lot of the increases in the quality of advice, because one of the issues, when I was looking at the data this morning, one of the issues that seems to have come out over the past couple of years is the clarity about the disclosure of relevant associations. So the banks used to be quite good at it, and then we had this period where, you know, everyone focused on it when the FSEA code came out, but this year people seem to have been dialing that back a bit. And I don't know whether that's as a result of QAR discussions or this idea that we're moving into, once QAR is implemented, we're moving into this brave new world where there's not going to be any regulation and it's going to be so much easier. And we also said, like, one of the things we get about QAR is, well, once it happens, there'll be no need for compliance. And you go, no, there'll be an incredible need for lawyers, because there's so many problems that are going to flow from this.
Yes, I can imagine how many lawyers already are chewing over the notion of good advice and how objective that will be in reality. That'll be an interesting one.
And can I just say on that point, particularly for advisors, is advisors often go to lawyers for advice. And I'm a lawyer, so this is a concession against interest. There are a lot of lawyers who don't really understand the financial services law, and you've always got to look at that advice. And there are some that understand the letter of the law but not the intent of it. And so we've seen some circumstances recently where the legal advice is spot on but is completely contradicted by every other aspect in terms of the regulatory expectations, the Royal Commission and whatever. It's not enough for the advice, for legal advice to be correct. If you're a licensee or an advisor, you've also got to look at it through that lens of your professional obligations as well as your obligations to your client.
Sure. Okay, great. That's a good note to finish on, Sean. It's been wonderful having you here on the Brilliant Investment Thinking Shared podcast. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. See you next time.